Today, answers matter more than ever before. That's why IBM is helping businesses manage customer questions with Watson Assistant. It's conversational AI designed to work for any industry. Let's put smart to work. Visit ibm.com/Watson Assistant.
This is DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg.
Now, Rick, my understanding is the big guest is waiting in with us. Is that correct? You've done some magical work here?
Yeah, you're correct. Yeah, I mean, this is going to be a great start to the week with this noon hour.
All right, let's bring him in. I mean, really, the face of ESPN, the wonderful and talented Mike Greenberg. Good afternoon, Mike. How are you?
I'm good, fellas. I will admit, like a lot of other New Yorkers, I'm probably feeling a little sad today because of the news about Jerry Stiller. I can't be the only one in this conversation who thinks that's the greatest Seinfeld is the greatest television show of all time. And I spent my drive home today while listening to you guys thinking about all of the incredibly funny things he did on Seinfeld. So I'm sure a lot of people in New York are thinking about him today.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my favorite show. I mean, it's right in my wheelhouse when I was, you know, finishing high school, getting into my 20s, and the humor is so brilliant. Have you ever seen, Greeny, the outtakes where they're at the police station and Elaine just can't finish the scene because he's just cracking her up every single time?
Yes, when he keeps saying, "You want a piece of me?"
But I
tweeted just now, if you forced me to pick my favorite Seinfeld episode, and it's hard to do, I think I would pick The Caddy, which is the episode where, among other things, they think that George is dead, and George Steinbrenner goes to Frank and Estelle's house to inform them that George is dead. And immediately, Jerry Stiller, as Frank Costanza, launches into a rant in which he says, "What the hell did you trade Jay Buna for?" And it might be my single favorite moment in the history of that show. So he was so damn funny.
So funny, and sadly passes away at the age of 92. And I still watch. Do you still watch it every night, Greeny?
Yes.
11 o'clock. I still turn on Seinfeld. It feels like it's the show that it never is outdated. It's always good.
Well, it's interesting, and this is, I'm sure, not what you guys called me to talk about today, so I won't sidetrack us so much. But interestingly, I don't know if your kids are probably too young for this, but my kids watch Friends religiously on Netflix and will not watch Seinfeld because Seinfeld is so of its time. They find it very dated. It was very much of its era. And so you and I find it incredibly funny because we remember that era, and it doesn't feel like all that long ago. But whereas Friends seems to have maintained a level of popularity, I'm talking about much younger people. I'm talking about teenagers. So I still watch Seinfeld religiously. But my kids, they think it is – I mean, there's an entire episode that is built around George waiting for a call on a payphone in the coffee shop from Tatiana. And that just does not register with my kids.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I still watch and think it's the greatest thing I've ever
seen.
Oh, I think it would pain me. I think if I offered it to my kids and they watched it and like, "Dad, this just isn't funny," which there's a good chance that would happen, it would actually pain me.
Oh, it pains me. Yeah, you have no idea the pain. I mean, it pains me enormously. They don't like my music. They don't like my television. I can't talk them into much. Anyway, what's going on, fellas? I'm sorry that I sidetracked the conversation before it even began.
Oh, stop. All right, so Greeny's with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So obviously Sam Darnold's on the K-Show today, 5:30. I'm sure you're going to be listening to that. We haven't talked to you since pre-draft for the Jets. So tell us, what did you think? How do you feel about Joe Douglas in year one and how he did in the draft for his first go-around?
Mostly very good. The more I look at the pick of the tackle in the first round, the more I like it. I will confess that at the moment, as I watched that with my son that night, we were hoping that the Jets would take one of the explosive receivers, the Jerry Jeudy, C.D. Lamb. They were sitting there for them if they wanted them. And my first reaction was that's what they really needed. But the more thought I have given to it, the more I have come to feel that the best thing the Jets can do right now on offense for Sam is to build that line. And they have remade their offensive line completely this offseason, and that's probably the right thing for them to do. And if that comes together well, that's probably the best thing they can do for the development of Darnold. The receiver they take on the second round obviously is, I mean, fast as lightning and has all the physical tools. Everything I've read about him and heard from the people who cover it for us is that he's very raw. If he turns into a good player, then this will wind up having been a really good draft. And then the big question, though, with the Jets will remain that on the offensive side. Aside from Crowder and, I guess, Le'Veon Bell, who is Darnold going to be throwing the ball to? And if the answer to that question can be found in a meaningful way, then I think the Jets have a chance to as tough as the schedule is, and it is brutal, if they don't get buried early like they did a year ago, I think they have a chance to be in playoff contention most of the year, because I think New England is falling back to the pack, and I'm not buying on Buffalo as much as most other people are.
Greeny, I want to get into, you know, some of the stuff last night with The Last Dance, because you covered that. I mean, you lived that. But since we're on the Jets, I guess I'll ask you the Jets question first. So in saying all of that, I mean, if I were to ask you now, you know, outside of maybe potentially weapons, you as a Jets fan, what is your biggest concern with this team as we approach this upcoming season? Well, is it still potentially, you know, you don't trust the coach?
Well, certainly. That's a huge one. But that hasn't changed from the end of the season. If I had to look at the way they've remade or what the work they've done on the roster concerns I have or the questions I have there surround A, the weapons on the outside on offense, and then B, what's going to happen with Jamal Adams? And what do you guys think? What ultimately is going to happen here? Because I have very mixed feelings. Look, I love the kid, and he's obviously a great player. And there's not a team in the NFL that would not be made better by having him. But I do wonder if the way football is played in 2020, if building your defense, if you're just sort of assigning amounts of money to different positions on the field, if building your defense around a safety is the way to do it. And again, I'm not in any way diminishing him. I don't think you can play that position any better than he does. But I just wonder if that's where you want to spend all of that money. So I was watching with really close interest how they would handle that, and I'll be very interested to see where it goes from here.
Well, I guess when you're not paying your quarterback top of the market money, you do have the luxury of being able to overpay at a position like safety. It's not necessarily one of those spots where you feel like NFL teams would prioritize those guys getting paid top of the market money. So it just seems like it would make sense, while you have Sam still on his rookie contract, that you would go ahead and reward one of the actual draft picks that you used in the top 10 that panned out.
Yes. Look, again, I hear you, and I don't disagree with what you're saying. And if they decide to make Adams the highest paid safety in the sport, I will not complain. He absolutely deserves it. I guess the question is, are you then putting yourself in a position when you do have to pay Darnold? I guess ultimately Bell won't be there forever. You know, they're going to have a lot of money to move around and all of that, but they're going to pay Darnold. I remain a believer in Darnold. I think he's going to be terrific. And I think he's going to be the Jets quarterback for the next decade plus, which means they're going to have to pay him big money at some point. And that's going to sort of reshuffle things. And the most valuable thing to have, to the point that you're making and the entire NFL right now, is a quarterback on a rookie contract. You want to win while that's happening. So they basically have another year or two to do that. But I guess two, really. You don't have to redo the deal after year three, although, you know, if some teams had, they might be in a better position than they are now. So the time to try and win is right now. Brady is gone. Arnold's on a rookie contract. This is the time. And I think if everything breaks their way, they have a chance.
And Greeny, I want to revisit the questions that we have around Adam Gase as the head coach for this team. Everybody gave him a pass last year because it was his first season with the team. You still had Mike Maccagnan running the offseason with free agency in the draft before you decided to part company with him. But what are the expectations for Adam Gase from Jets fans coming into 2020? What does this season have to look like for you in order to have confidence in your head coach moving forward?
Well, let's see. I want Le'Veon Bell to have the ball about three times more than he had it last year, and in more creative ways. I understand that Gase didn't want him, but you've got him, and he is an extraordinarily expensive and potentially dynamic weapon that you have on your team. He's the only offensive weapon they have on their team that other teams are going to be even remotely afraid of. So find creative ways to use him. My biggest issue with Gase all through last year from start to finish was that he obviously didn't want Bell, and I thought that he had an agenda with that the entire season long. Throw out the time that Darnold had mono, because that was just an unbridled disaster that nothing was going to overcome. But to me, the time for making the point that you didn't want this guy in the first place is long since over. Le'Veon Bell has another, call it, 2 or 3 years to be one of the truly great dynamic offensive weapons in the National Football League. Take advantage of that starting immediately. That's what I want to see.
Greeny's with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So you said, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, that Darnold is going to be a really good quarterback, going to be here for a long time. But do you feel kind of this slow groundswell? Because we even have hosts here at the station where if he doesn't have a big-time year this year, I'm going to start looking for another quarterback. I don't know. It seems so strange to me, but it feels like this really is a very big year for Sam Darnold.
I agree. I agree with your premise that people seem to be talking that way, which, candidly, I don't get at all. I thought Darnold Darnold is still younger than Joe Burrow, who won the Heisman this past year and is coming in as a rookie. I mean, Darnold is very young and left 2 years of college on the table. It was always going to take a little time, and then changed offensive systems and got mono going into his second year. And yes, he still has the extraordinarily frustrating habit of throwing a lot of interceptions, and particularly throwing them at the most crippling of possible times. But that's what Adam Gase is for. He's supposed to be the quarterback whisperer. That's why he is the head coach of the New York Jets, and it's his job to coach up Darnold. I think Darnold has as much talent, just pure talent, as any quarterback the Jets have had in my lifetime. I'm not old enough to have seen Namath in his prime. I've never seen the Jets have a quarterback as talented as this guy is, from Richard Todd on until the present day. So it's the coach's job to turn him into a great player, which I think he absolutely has the potential to be. And if Jet fans are thinking about Trevor Lawrence or anything like that, forget it. First of all, they're not going to be terrible this year. The Jaguars are tanking for Trevor Lawrence. The Jaguars are doing everything they can not to win any games this year. Second of all, I'm not even sure Trevor Lawrence is going to be the first pick in the draft next year. Ohio State has a quarterback named Justin Fields that by the end of next season may surpass him. And third of all, we should be rallying around the idea that Darnold is going to be the franchise quarterback for the next 15 years. That's the best thing that could happen to the franchise, and I think it's going to happen.
Well, lucky for your sanity, Greeny, we have Frank Gore now to lessen the load on Lev Bell, so I'm sure you're going to love that.
I don't have a problem with bringing in someone else to get some carries. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is I cannot remember off the top of my head one moment last year where I thought to myself, wow, that was using Le'Veon Bell in a really creative way. I mean, what the hell? He's supposed to be an offensive genius. Find creative ways to use this incredibly dynamic, unique weapon. I mean, he was I don't need to remind everyone of all the numbers. He averaged more yards rushing per game than Emmitt Smith and more receiving yards per game than Chris Carter. He's a Hall of Fame runner and receiver. And the Jets turned him into just a run-of-the-mill good back last year. That's terrible. And, I'm willing to write off the entire first half of the season. But find creative ways to use that guy. That's the number one thing I want to say.
All right, Greeny, let me ask you a Chicago Bulls-related question, because that's why I really wanted you on, because you live this. I mean, what would you say, and I really loved the two episodes we got a chance to watch last night, but, I mean, we took some phone calls today talking about Michael Jordan punching Steve Kerr, and he was a bad teammate. Well, what would you say to someone that thinks that Michael Jordan was a bad teammate?
I think you would have to say, and listen, I would defer to you and Chris on this as former players. Here's my vantage point from one who covered it all. I don't think that playing for Bill Belichick is a lot of fun. But the only thing less fun than playing for Bill Belichick is losing a lot. So if you think winning is fun and winning is the ultimate objective, then playing with Michael Jordan in the end was the best thing that could happen to you. I don't think that every minute of the time that it was going on, you would have felt that way. Jordan demanded of others their very best at all times and was willing to give it himself at all times. I don't think that made him, I don't think that would have made him a fun person to be around. But ultimately, I think that was his vision of leading. That was the way he viewed leadership. I think that was what he perceived to be the best way he could to give his teams and himself the best chance to win championships, which was his singular goal. And he did it better than anyone of his era and about as well as anyone in the history of American team sports. So I think it's very difficult to take that away from him. If you want to suggest that leading that way, that being that tough on your teammates, makes you not a great teammate, I'm not going to argue with you, because I don't know that I would have had a lot of fun playing with him. But I bet you that when Steve Kerr, who got punched in that famous time, or Will Perdue, who called him what he called him on TV last night, and all these other guys, when they open up their safety deposit box and see those rings, I bet you they don't think about how nasty Michael was to them, but they think about the great moments and the huge wins and the championships. And if that's what it's all about, then I think it was worth the trade-off. I'll also tell you that having been around, it was my job to cover Michael Jordan every single day for almost 6 years, that being around him in that capacity, he was as easy to deal with and as nice and as likable and as reasonable a person, considering his stature, considering that at that time, I believe he was the most famous person in the world. He was remarkably easy to deal with, and I saw him in moments that demonstrated that he was just he was and I believe is a decent person. But I think that I mean that in a that almost sounds like underdoing it. I think he's a good person, but I think that his competitiveness, his almost excruciating competitive drive, probably made him difficult to be around rather regularly. And if you think that makes him a bad teammate, I'm not going to try and argue.
You know what, Greeny? There's something about it that I respect. When you have an athlete that understands the cost of winning and is unwilling to compromise that and unwilling to allow his teammates to compromise that, I think that's something that's really special. But since we're talking about the cost of winning, I got to ask you about Stephen Jones' comments regarding the Dak Prescott contract this weekend. They said they're not going to rescind the tag, but clearly the two sides are still apart on this, and I understand there's some disagreement about the structure of the deal. Jeff Darlington talking about the years being a sticking point. To me, this is one of those situations where Jerry and Stephen Jones are compromising the opportunity to capitalize on a championship window that they have created by drafting and developing a lot of good players. Am I wrong for looking at it that way?
Well, I think you're not. Not only are you not wrong, but I think you're not even going far enough in the criticism. What the Joneses are doing makes no logical sense, or at least has no logical consistency to what they have done previously. So Stephen Jones cannot this year say, we have statistics and analytics that demonstrate you can't pay the quarterback above a certain amount. A year after ripping up Ezekiel Elliott's contract and without absolutely any leverage, making Zeke Elliott the highest paid running back in the National Football League, when the last time an NFL leading rusher won the Super Bowl was in a previous millennium, and the last team to lead the league in rushing and win the Super Bowl was the 85 Bears. So there is nowhere that you look in the analytics book of NFL and say, oh yeah, rip up the contract of your running back long before you have to and pay him while he's in Cabo. Not only does it make no sense from an analytics standpoint, but it also sends the absolute wrong message to all the rest of the players on your team, which is the squeaky wheel really does get the grease here. So it doesn't matter if what Stephen Jones is saying is right or wrong. It completely contradicts the way they have done business previously. So for the life of me, I have no idea what they're doing with Dak, and I have no idea where it's going to go from here.
Well, as a Giants fan, I kind of love the direction that it's headed right now, and I don't have a lot on my plate when it comes to Big Blue. Greeny with us here, 98.7 ESPN. What were the years that you covered Jordan and the Bulls, Mike?
91 through 96.
91 through 96. So you were there when the Knicks played them both in 92 and in 94. You
all
were there. You were at the game where Pippen wouldn't go back into the game with 1.8
correct.
Seconds left, huh?
Yes.
So what was the feeling around that? I mean, you watch it now and it's such an awful look and it feels like it was similar back then. Were you shocked by that?
Yes. I can tell you three things that happened, okay, that completely changed the history of it. So Scottie Pippen refuses to go back into a tie game with 1.8 seconds left at home on a Friday night in a game three down 2-0. The first thing that then happens is that Kukoc throws in a very tough shot to win game three. If that shot doesn't go in, the Bulls are going to lose in overtime. They're going to get swept, and that is going to become the biggest thing. It is going to completely change Scottie Pippen's legacy. But that doesn't happen. Kukoc makes the shot. The next thing that happens is that game was played on a Friday night, and game four was played on a Sunday afternoon in Chicago. So there were basically 36 hours between those two games. There wasn't a lot of time for it to sink in. I was on the radio in Chicago at that time, and I remember spending an entire day talking about it. But that's all we had was one day to talk about it, because the Bulls then came back and won game four, which sends the series back to New York for game five, which is where the third and most important thing happens. The Hugh Hollins call, I can tell you guys right now, I'm a New Yorker, who grew up a Knicks season ticket holder and lived and died with the Knicks all of my life. I then went to Chicago to cover the Bulls, and so I can tell you those series were viewed completely differently from the two sides. So while I'm sure that series is not always remembered for the Hugh Hollins foul call in Game 5 in New York, it most certainly is in Chicago. To this day, that is known as the Hugh Hollins game, and it changed the narrative completely. And, of course, it changes the outcome of the series. The Knicks wind up winning Game 5, which they would not have. Chicago wins Game 6 at home, but the Knicks win Game 7 easily, and that's the end of that. History is completely rewritten, if not for that foul call. That is now exclusively the way people remember that series in Chicago. It's like Scotty not going back into that game with 1.8 seconds, incredibly, is an afterthought. When people remember that series, because they believe that they in Chicago, the fans and the team, believe they fought their way back in, that they would have won the series, but they got robbed on a bad call in Game 5 in the Garden. So those three things, I think, are the reasons that Scottie Pippen is not remembered much more for those 1.8 seconds than he is. He should thank his lucky stars every day, because it is one of the worst moves that you've ever seen a great player make in your entire life. It is, again, to Rick and to Chris, I would say, is there any worse sin that a player can commit than saying, when the game is on the line, at any time for that matter, but when the game is on the line, no, I'm not going in right now. I can't think of another time I've seen it happen, and I can't think of a worse thing a player can do. So I think he is very, very fortunate that the three things I just listed for you happened, which have made that moment almost completely forgotten.
Hey, Greeny, and I wanted to ask you a question regarding that. I mean, how surprised were you to hear, you know, Scottie Pippen actually say if he could go back, he wouldn't change it? That seemed kind of ridiculous.
I have no idea what he's saying. I mean, because he leading up to that, every comment he made suggested he understands how terrible it was. and he tearfully apologized to his teammates right after it happened. And Bill Cartwright, who was a great leader, actually, on those teams, you saw him wearing him out on the bench. And apparently, after the game in the locker room, and this was the story at the time and remains, that Cartwright was practically uncontrollable. He was so angry and screaming at Pippen, and that Scottie tearfully apologized. So for him to say all of those things and then say, but if I had to do it again, I would do it the same way, it just doesn't make any sense to me at all. Candidly, and in my opinion, and I haven't had the opportunity to talk to Scottie about this, it's a ridiculous thing to say, because I think he recognizes just how wrong it was. And I would think that if he had the opportunity to do it again, he would do it the absolute opposite way.
Greeny, since you were around the team and covering them, I think you're the perfect person to ask this question. Right after Michael Jordan's father passed, I thought it was a little unfair that people were trying to create this connection between his untimely demise and Michael Jordan's addiction to gambling. Did you feel like that in real time?
Yeah, so there were two schools, there were two groups of people in Chicago, and I think beyond Chicago at that time. Those who did and those who didn't believe in the conspiracy theories. There were two conspiracy theories that I've never believed. One of them is Michael Jordan prematurely retired because David Stern surreptitiously suspended him for 18 months for gambling and didn't want the world to know about it because it would have been a scandal that brought down the NBA. That was a theory that was espoused by credible people, not just people. Well, there was no internet then, but, you know, not just voices on the internet, but credible people would say that out loud. I've never believed it to be true. I didn't believe it then. I don't believe it now. The other thing that credible people believed and said out loud was that if it felt possible that there was a connection between Michael Jordan's gambling and the tragic murder of his father. I have never believed that, didn't believe it then, and do not believe it now. I do believe that Michael's father's murder is the reason that he retired. I think he was spent emotionally, physically. Just think back to where he was then. 91, he wins the championship. 92, he wins the championship. Both grueling. Did not want to go to the Olympics in the summer of 92, but that was the dream team. It was the biggest thing ever. The NBA wasn't going to let him not go, and Nike wasn't going to let him not go. So he spent the entire summer of 92 playing with the dream team and then comes back and wins another title in 93. So he is exhausted emotionally, physically, mentally, and in every other way. And then his father gets killed, I believe, tragically, coincidentally, and having nothing to do with anything except sometimes tragic things happen. And I believe that those, the combination of all of that was too much for him to handle. And he just said, you know what, I need to get away. And that's what he did. And he couldn't go back to training camp and start because the season was getting ready to start soon, or at least the, you know, the preseason. And so that was why he retired. So that I've always thought. But I've never believed that there was any connection between Jordan's gambling and his father's murder. And I've never believed that the NBA secretly suspended him. But I can tell you back then that lots of people, real people, credible people, did believe both of those things.
Mike Greenberg is with us here, 98.7 ESPN. So did you follow Jordan into kind of the baseball realm when he retired from the NBA and follow him there, or did you stay on,
yes,
on the
board?
You did.
I followed him. I went to Sarasota, Florida in the spring of 1994, where I lived in a house, true story. There were four of us that went there. The first day that Jordan was in spring training, there were probably 500 reporters there. Ted Koppel did Nightline from there. By the end of the first week, there were four of us. There was the Chicago Tribune, the Chicago Sun-Times, the Daily Herald, which is a suburban paper, and me. The other three reporters who were there all stayed in the only hotel in Sarasota, which was the Ritz-Carlton. My station did not have anywhere near the budget to put me in the Ritz-Carlton. So I rented a room in a house on Siesta Key. The other five residents of the house were women, median age 87.
So it's your Del Boca Vista moment.
I lived there for the entirety of the time that Michael was in spring training. He was with the major league team for most of it. Then when they sent him to Birmingham, the Birmingham Barons of AA, managed by Terry Francona, that was when I went back to Chicago. They did not send me to Birmingham. So I was with him for the entirety of the time that he was in Sarasota.
Greeny, do you get the sense that he would have stayed in baseball if it wasn't for the strike?
No. I am surprised he stayed with it as long as he did. Michael Jordan, and I think you all saw this last night, Michael Jordan was consumed with being the best in the world at something. And he wasn't anywhere near the best in the world at baseball. To say that if Michael Jordan had gotten 1,500 at-bats, he would have made the major leagues is being very kind and also being very, very phony. I was there. Michael Jordan, by normal human standards, was a very good baseball player. He would not have made the major leagues, in any real way. I suppose they could have put him in the major leagues because he was Michael Jordan. But if his name had been, you know, Michael Horowitz, he would have had less chance of making the major leagues back then than I did. Now, I'm not saying if he had stuck with it from the time he was 17, he couldn't have done it. Maybe he could have. I don't know. Although not too many guys who were 6'6 make it as outfielders because his strike zone was so big. But I was there to watch every single game he played in spring training. And I'm telling you, and I'm not a baseball scout, but when you watch them play, you guys know where the press box is located. Practically every baseball stadium in the world, it is located high above home plate. So the view you get of the outfield is, as a reporter, is when you see a fly ball hit, you immediately see the outfielder start moving. And it was not until I covered Michael Jordan that I recognized how great the major league outfielders are. Because if you ever watch a major league game, the second the ball is hit, the crack of the bat, these guys are on a dead run to exactly the right spot immediately. Every one of them, practically every time. Michael Jordan took at least two steps in the wrong direction every time a fly ball was hit to the outfield. And that's not because he isn't a great athlete. It's because he hadn't played thousands and thousands and thousands of innings in the outfield, which you have to do in order to be a major league player. So Michael Jordan was never going to be a major league baseball player. And he knew it pretty quickly. And I think I can't believe it took him as long as it did to say, I need to go back there and be the best basketball player in the world again, which there was never any question in his mind or mine that he could do. So I am almost a little surprised that he didn't go back sooner. Now, he was not going to allow himself to be used as a pawn in the CBA stuff. That is true. But he was not going to be a major league player anyway. I think he was always going to go back to basketball.
Greeny, over the weekend, we had a return to contact sports with UFC 249. I'm interested to get your overall thoughts on how you think the UFC did, but I also want to know what you think this means for other sports leagues as we try to ramp things back up.
Well, I think they did well. I think that the initial reaction everyone had when one of the fighters tested positive for the virus was the wrong one, or at least it was mine was. When I first heard one of the fighters tested positive, I thought, oh, no. Is the event in jeopardy? But as I came to think about it, and I heard Dana say afterwards, it actually means the system worked. They had the testing. They were able to find an athlete who was positive, identify him, get him whatever assistance he needs, go through the proper protocols with him, and keep everyone else safe. So I think, and I'm certainly wide open to someone pointing out to me something that I'm not aware of that would change my opinion, I think it was a huge success. And the position I've taken, guys, on my show, and just as a person who loves sports since this all began, is it costs you the same to be optimistic as it does to be pessimistic. So I'm going to be optimistic. I'm also not going to be unrealistic. I'm not going to lie to my audience. I'm extraordinarily hopeful that there will be a method figured out or methods figured out that sports, that baseball, that basketball, that hockey, ultimately football, and all the rest can come back in such a way that it does not compromise the safety and health of anyone, of the players, of coaches, of support people, and of fans. If that can be done, I will be delighted because I miss sports, and I think all of us who love sports do, and I think it would be wonderful for the national psyche to have something fun to cheer for again. Realistically speaking, I do not believe we are going to see packed stadiums again this year, certainly not in New York. I know they're talking about down in the south, you know, in the southern part of the country, the SEC and all of that, playing with fans. Time will tell. But I do believe, let me put it this way, I believe that the people who run the NBA believe, the people who run Major League Baseball believe, and the people who run the National Football League believe that they're going to play this year in some fashion with the fans in some way probably incrementally increasing. And if so, I think that would be a great win because I think all of us miss it. And so long as it can be done safely, I think it would be great for everyone, both financially and otherwise, to see these games come back because I think they're an important part of our culture. And I think it will make a big difference, again, if safely they can return.
Greeny, last one for me. Mike Greenberg here with us on 98.7 ESPN. You're similar to me. We love our teams. We live and we die with them. We can't get enough of them. You're a Knicks fan. You grew up in New York, and then you go out to Chicago. You go to Northwestern. You get a job covering the Bulls. How hard was that? I mean, you're a Knicks fan. The Knicks were a terrific basketball team, and they had so many opportunities. And every time they did, you're there covering the Bulls, watching your beloved Knicks lose. I mean, is that something that was difficult? Are you such a straight-focused journalist that you can just watch the Bulls, enjoy the game as someone covering that team, and not get caught up in the fact that you love the Knicks?
It was a little bit of both. So my parents... my father was still alive then, and my parents are crazy sports fans. In fact, you know, Dave, when your dad died, that beautiful piece that I read about him that Mike Vaccaro wrote, it reminded me very much, you know, that relationship reminded me very much of that with my father, although mm-hmm. my father would have taken me to the Super Bowl anyway. I could have gotten straight Fs, and my father would have taken me to the Super Bowl anyway, but that's neither here nor there. So I'm traveling back and forth between Chicago and New York, and when I'm in New York, I'm staying in my parents' apartment. My parents owned a store that had a huge Go New York, Go New York, Go sign in the window. So, like, we're crazy Knicks fans on one side. And on the other side, I'm hosting radio shows and doing reports on the station where we're taking call after call after call from Bulls fans. It wasn't as hard as you would think because I don't know, Dave, much about your history covering. Were you always a talk guy? Or were you out there covering stuff?
Well, I lived in Raleigh for a while, and I covered the Carolina Hurricanes. But okay. If and when they played the Rangers, I rooted for the Rangers.
You can root for the Rangers, but I don't know, at least in my case, I got very wrapped up in what I was doing. So when the games were going on, when I was doing in locker rooms doing interviews, when I was working, I wasn't really thinking about that part of it. When I had private time, like when I was sitting alone by myself, yes. But I was in the building when Starks, I was walking down. I remember where I was standing when Starks dunked left-handed on Jordan and Pippen at the end of game two in 93. And I remember thinking to myself as I was walking down, oh, my God, the Knicks are going to beat Michael Jordan. I mean, they're going to win. And I was very, very happy about that. But then I was in there and I'm interviewing Riley and interviewing Phil and doing all the rest of the work you have to do. And I wasn't really thinking about it. So I don't think it interfered with my ability to cover the series. But there's no question I was rooting for the Knicks. And when the Knicks won in 94 and went on to the finals, which was really the first time in my lifetime that I had seen the Knicks have a chance to play for a championship. I'm not old enough to remember 73. I was 5 years old. I don't really have any recollection of that. My favorite Knicks teams in the early 90s were the Bernard King teams, the Hubie teams. You know, those were the closest they ever came. taking Boston to 7 and 84 and some of that stuff. So in 94 was the first time I ever saw the Knicks play for a championship. And that broke my heart. The Starks game in game six and everything else, the terrible call, the offensive foul on Ewing in game three of that series were devastating for me. But when they were playing the Bulls and I was working as closely with that as I was, most of the time I was too busy to really think about it that way.
All right, Mike, listen, we'd love to keep you forever. We do have to run a couple commercials. You're welcome on any time. I mean, we'll talk Jets, we'll talk Knicks, we'll talk history, we'll talk whatever. So it's an open invitation on the show.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks, guys, for having me. It's good to catch up. And I'm thrilled to see people enjoying this this Last Dance because, it's like looking back into my youth. It was the most thrilling experience of my professional life. I was 24 years old when I started on the road with those guys, and it was just an amazing experience. I'm so glad everyone's having such a good time watching it.
It really is great. We appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Thank you.
So good. That, of course, is Jerry Stiller, who passes away today at the age of 92, and Greeny was mentioning that. I can't believe, Rick, that Seinfeld doesn't stand the test of time with the kids of this generation.
Yeah, listen, at some point, I mean, my son's too young. But, I mean, at some point, he's going to get a taste of it, and we'll see if he likes it or not.
Yeah, I hope he likes it. Honestly, I'm not exaggerating. It would pain me if I watched it with my kids and they're like, "Ugh, this is what you enjoy. This is awful."
I mean, is that out of the realm of possibilities, though?
No, I think you're afraid very to do much. It. I think it's very much within the realm of possibility. In fact, we were making breakfast for Sherry yesterday. She was lying in bed. We were making breakfast, and I turned the Beatles on, and Ben turns to me and goes, "This is the music you like?" I was like, "It's the Beatles, dude."
Wow.
He's like, "Yeah, but this is awful."
See, I'm lucky. Milo loves, for some reason, I don't know what it is. He loves the Beatles. He loves Queen. Like, he loves old.
Well, how could you not like the Beatles?
Dude, he walked into the room the other day singing Welcome to the Jungle.
That's awesome.
He's sick.
Yeah, no, he's all wrapped up in the current day music, which I guess we all do, right?
Yeah, but some things, though, I mean, just, they stand the test of time. Like, I mean,
like a Biggie album.
Yeah, exactly,
yeah.
Right. I miss Biggie.
I got it. Yeah. Say no more.
All right. Are we doing a quick observations?
I don't know if we have time. How many calls do we have? I mean, how many calls do we have?
We could take a couple calls and then you can really pack it in tomorrow for an extended observations.
Yeah. See, I like that. I mean, we kept Greeny. I still had a couple more questions for Greeny too. But I mean, see, I told you we could have kept him the whole hour.
Oh, absolutely.
We could have had him the whole show and we still wouldn't have got all our questions out.
See, I wanted to know because he was there. I mean, he lived it. I wanted to know, like, from his own personal experience, how bad the relationship between Jordan and Krause. Jerry Krause really was. Yeah,
it's not documented very well, right? It doesn't seem like.
How about
it was
that
easy.
Question? How about the question last night when
Craig
Krause
Sager?
Goes to... Thanks a lot, Craig.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness! Too much.
Yeah, so I'm thinking we table observations for today. Come back with it in a heavy dose tomorrow, as long with the game show that you have originated, and we do that in the noon hour tomorrow.
I love it.
All right, so we have a couple calls. Let's get to those. Let's go to D in Queens. D, you're next up on 98.7.
Hey, how you doing? I got 3 points. They mix together. One, I know you're going to disagree with, but let me just go real quick. First of all, Jordan didn't have to act that way to win. He didn't have to. It's like he wanted to. And because he won.
How do you know that, D? D, how do you know that?
Let me finish. Please. You know, we can't complain about the current state of how things are going in the world as a whole and say the ends always justify the means. They don't. You know, and the thing is, he tried that same act in Washington, and it didn't work. The people actually hated him and resented him, and the team actually got stunted because.
But why? Because he wasn't the same player.
He wasn't as good.
It was later stages of his career.
No, that's true. But also, in Chicago, to me, Jordan was in a bubble, and he disrespects Jerry Krause a lot. But it's also karma that in the same exact role, him and Phil are absolutely atrocious. So it could have been Jerry Krause understood the psychological profile a lot of players that would fit with Jordan mentally. You know, maybe it's you know, I never heard of Tim Duncan carrying himself that way. Kareem is the most accomplished basketball player ever. I never heard him carrying on that way. Everyone's different.
Yeah, but that was his
DNA. Everyone's different. Yeah, but time out. Everyone's different. I get it. And sometimes the, you know, the ends don't justify the means. But, I mean, and maybe Michael Jordan looks back now. I mean, if asked the question, it has, and maybe because he's living it right now, has more respect for what Jerry Krause did with those Bulls teams. But that didn't change in the moment how he felt about Jerry Krause.
Yeah, but I don't know how you can jump to the conclusion and say that Michael Jordan didn't have to do that in order for the Bulls to have the kind of success that they did. Like, and let's keep in mind, like, the Chicago Bulls were the laughing stock of the NBA. That was not the situation with the LA Lakers when Kareem got there. They had already won championships. The Bulls weren't a championship organization. So I just think it's a little bit ridiculous to jump out there and say Jordan didn't have to do that in order to have two three-peats in the modern NBA.
And that's what made him tick. Like him focusing so crazily and having this desperation to win is the DNA that made up Michael Jordan. So to say he shouldn't have done it, that's what he was.
No, that's what he was too. But here's the other thing though, Dave, and it's the toughest part about, you know, repeating as champions. I mean, it doesn't happen a lot. Is you're not necessarily what about the great players on your team getting complacent. It's all the other players in the team getting complacent, right? And there's not nearly as much turnover on NBA teams as there is on NFL teams. So the last thing you would want if you're Michael Jordan is to let the guys on your team now, okay, they got a taste of a championship. Do they now take their foot off the gas a little bit and they're complacent?
And he even said last night that Steve Kerr and I guess maybe it was Burrell, I forget, or some of those guys, he felt like that without even having ever won a championship before, right? They just came to the second generation of the Bulls in the 96 season, and they already kind of had that attitude.
Yeah, but that's how you, I mean, that's, and again, it's who knows? Like, you can't sit here and pretend like you know if, you know, one way or the other, Michael Jordan needed to do what he needed to do. In his mind, that's how he needed to lead.
And he won six times. So
exactly
it's hard to argue it as distasteful as it may
come across. It's not different, but it's him as a player, right? Like, people need to understand, there aren't a lot of players that are willing to do what Michael Jordan did. It's usually not the best players that do that. Like, I mean, Chris has been part of teams when, you know, you got average guys that are the best leaders because they don't care about your feelings. They're not trying to be buddies. They're trying to get the best out of you, get the best out of the team. That's usually what the coach does. I mean, what Michael Jordan did is more powerful because he's a player, but it's no different than what, you know, how Bill Belichick coaches.
He did it all. He absolutely did all. Can you imagine being Mike Greenberg? You're 24 years old. You graduate from Northwestern and you now are the beat reporter for, I mean, arguably the best team, certainly within the last 40 years of the NBA. And that is now your job? Cover Michael Jordan, Scottie Pippen, and just travel around the country with these guys?
And you're living with a house full of 87-year-old women in Sarasota.
How great is that?
Golden Girls. Perfect.
Right.
You don't know any better at 24. I mean, you live in the dream.
So good. Love it. I mean,
you
cover the Bulls.
I can't believe you asked him. He's covering, I mean, the greatest player of all time. Well, I mean, probably the greatest team of all time. And you're concerned if it's hard because he's a Knicks fan.
Yeah.
Really?
I wanted to know. I thought it was a terrific question.
I mean, even if you're a Knicks fan, Dave, you got to admit you appreciate what Michael Jordan did, right?
No, I mean, I guess, but you have a tremendous dislike for him.
Well, aren't you locked into this docuseries?
Yeah, I love it.
Don't you find it fascinating?
Yeah, I also find it painful. I find it like you're bringing me back through painful memories of my youth.
Yeah, but Dave, even if you didn't have to talk about it for a living, like, you would still sit down and watch it. That's how much you appreciate what it is that Michael Jordan did. And I know it brings up some painful memories, but it also gives you a chance to look back and reflect on the greatest basketball player ever.
It doesn't make it any less painful, though. It's still awful.
No, I'm just saying, if you're a Knicks fan like Greeny was, going back and covering the team and having a chance to see that up close and personal, I just think that you have no choice but to have an appreciation for it.
I'm sure he does. And he said he was torn. Rick, I think this is very unfair of you. I thought it was an outstanding question.
I'm just busting chops. It was a good question.
And he even said he was really torn with the whole thing.
I'm sure he was. I mean, he was a season ticket holder. I just think it was funny that's just how your mind works. Like,
yeah,
that's like,
you know,
that's
me.
Your concern.
I know me. You know me.
DiPietro, Canty, and Rothenberg. Weekdays at 10 on 98.7 ESPN.